Okay, we have come to lesson 9, Genesis 29 through 33, five chapters. Would you say that a lot takes place in these five chapters?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, we're going to do things a little bit differently than we've done the last couple of weeks. We're actually here in a few minutes going to go through all of the different things that take place.
Obviously, we won't be able to go into as much detail as the text does, but I just thought, well, I'm having trouble keeping it all straight and getting it lined up in my mind, so maybe others are feeling similar to me. So we'll do that here in a few minutes. But there are a few things that I want to highlight, three things that I'd like to highlight before we get into that. And the first one is just to talk about the sons of Israel. We can't lose sight of the fact that a plan is unfolding, even as we read all of these different events. God's eternal plan is unfolding. Obviously, part of that plan is from Abraham's descendants to form a great nation. Well, that nation is going to be born from the descendants of Israel. His sons will, their descendants will form the nation of Israel. So, this all is important to the development of, or to the unfolding of God's plan. Of course, we know that Leah has Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. She has six sons altogether. And of course, she also has a daughter named Dinah. Okay. Rachel, of course, in the text tonight, only has Joseph, but later on, of course, she will give birth to Benjamin. I believe that's over in chapter 35. We'll get to that, I guess, next week. Bilhah, whose maiden was she? All right, Rachel's handmaiden, Bilhah, gave birth to Dan and Naphtali. And then Leah's handmaiden, Zilpah, gave birth to Gad and Asher. And so if we include Benjamin, of course, who hasn't been born yet, we have the 12 sons of Israel. Of course, we know tonight Jacob's name is going to be changed to Israel. So when we're talking about the 12 sons of Israel, we're talking about the 12 sons of Jacob. And again, they're going to form, their descendants will form the nation of Israel. All right, something else I kind of wanted to highlight for just a few minutes is the constant assurances that God was giving to Jacob. Now, we're not including anything that's been said previously. God has already spoken to him, and God has already given him some wonderful promises, some wonderful assurances. But just to note a few of the things tonight. First of all, when Laban turned against him, you know, when Jacob noticed that his countenance had changed and it looked like it's time to go, there in Genesis 31 and verse 3, the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your father, to your family, and I will be with you." And then you have the dream where the streaked, speckled, and spotted rams leaped on the flocks. And how was that reassurance to Jacob? Yeah. Right, that his flocks are going to be multiplied, that they are going to be blessed. And we're going to talk about this eventually, but I'll just go ahead and spoil the thing for later on. I don't think the peeled bark is what produced the abundant flock that they had. I think God just simply blessed him. There was the idea that, you know, animals, you know, whatever they looked upon last before they conceived, then, you know, they would give birth to something, you know, just like that. That was a prevalent idea, and I think probably there are probably some people in the world who still think along those lines, but I don't think that had anything to do with it. God was blessing him. And in the midst of that, now this is when Jacob is speaking to Rachel and Leah, and he's explaining why they're going to need to go home, and he's detailing all that happened, you know, with their father and so forth. But in the midst of this, the statement is also made, "I've seen what Laban's doing. God says, I've seen what Laban's doing, and I am blessing you." Okay. So another reassurance. When Jacob left Laban, you know, after they had
after Jacob had left, and then Laban pursued him for those 7 days and overtook him, and they had the kind of the confrontation there, and then they made a covenant of peace. Well, when Jacob left Laban, it says the angels met him. Not a lot of detail, but he calls the place Mahanaim, which means two multitudes or two companies or a double company, whatever the case may be. So even that is some reassurance to him. And then what he was told when he wrestled with the angel. I know he's not described as an angel here, but Hosea 12, 2 through 4, has some commentary on this very incident. And there, this man, so to speak, is called an angel. But what is he told at that time? Well, we know he said, your name's going to be Israel, but what else was said? What did he say about you have struggled? You have struggled with God and with men, and you have prevailed. Joseph calls the place, or Jacob, excuse me, calls the place Peniel. I can't remember exactly how it's the spelling there, but it has the idea of, I have seen the face of God. Now, did he literally look upon the face of God like 1 John 3 says that we will in eternity? No, I don't think so. But there's a close encounter. And so even this is great assurance to Jacob. And I think I've maybe mentioned this before, but sometimes we look at some of these biblical accounts where God is constantly speaking to people and giving them promises and reassurances, and we say, I think I'd do all right. I'd be a lot better off if God would do the same to me. Does He? He has. He doesn't speak directly like this, but we have exceedingly great and precious promises scattered all through the New Testament. And so, there's enough to sustain us. All we need to do is just go back and read them. Okay? God may not be speaking directly to us anymore, but the promises, the reassurances are there. But I just thought it was interesting that, God kept propping him up in this way. All right, and then just probably a better way to entitle this, but just God's attentiveness to what's going on with His people and with others. The fact that He sees and hears and knows, that He's intimately involved in what's going on with people. And to me, that just kind of stood out in my reading tonight. Let me give you some examples. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, He opened her womb. He noticed. He observed that she wasn't being loved and did this for her. The Lord has surely looked upon my affliction. And here we see that Leah understands that God is looking and seeing and knowing her condition. This, of course, is when she gave birth to that first child, Reuben. And then when she gave birth to Simeon, the second child, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved. Chapter 30 and verse 17, this is after, Leah had stopped bearing for a time and she had more children, said, God listened to Leah, and she conceived. Chapter 30 and verse 22, of course, Leah had all these children up to this point, and Rachel was barren, but finally God granted her a child. So God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. Chapter 31 and verse 12, we just mentioned that a few minutes ago, God said to Jacob, I have seen all that Laban is doing. Course, wasn't very happy about it. Chapter 31 and verse 42. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. That was Jacob speaking to Laban. Remember, what kind of rebuke did Laban give? Yeah, because, I don't think the best of intentions were in Laban's mind as he was making that 7 day journey, but God spoke to him, said, you say neither good nor bad toward him. And then in chapter 31 and verse 49, as many bad things as we can say about Laban, this is one good thing that he had to say when they made this covenant of peace with one another. May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. Now, I would encourage you, and I haven't really taken the time to go back and compile all of these, but we've been seeing this sort of thing all along. But that's something that means a lot to me personally, just to have that reassurance that God does see and hear and know. He remembers. He's conscious of what we're doing and what our problems are and what we need and that sort of thing. So, again, I think that's important for us to at least pay some attention to. All right, now let's go through and just sort of retell the events that take place in 29 through 33. And we'll try to stop all along and maybe highlight certain things. And if at some point you've got something that you want to add to, you know, this, please, you know, flash your hand up or speak up and just let me know. All right, so Jacob arrives in Padan Aram. You know, he's fleeing, of course, from Esau, but he's also been told to go there and seek a wife from his father's family. To Padan Aram, or Haran, and this is approximately a 400-mile journey. So that's a pretty good trip. You don't have the modes of transportation that we do. Jacob meets Rachel, to whom he is obviously attracted, finds out she is Laban's daughter, and tells her who he is. He knows that, you know, okay, she's someone of my father's family, and then of course he reassures her that the same is true with him. And then she runs to tell her father the news. Laban brings Jacob to his house, where Jacob stays for a month. Laban then offers to pay Jacob wages for his service. Okay, well, you know, you're a family member, but there's no reason why you should work for free, you know. We need to pay you for your services here. Well, what does Jacob want? He wants Rachel. That's the gift or the wage that he wants to receive from Laban. So Jacob agrees to serve Laban 7 years for Rachel. Well, here's the well-known passage. It gets often quoted. How did those 7 years seem to Jacob? Seemed only like a few days to him. For what reason? Because of his love for Rachel. There in chapter 29 and verse 20. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. So he was certainly smitten by Rachel. Alright, so Jacob serves the 7 years, asks for Rachel. Now, okay, I've put in my time. Let her come and be my wife, says that to Laban, but is given Leah instead. But he didn't figure it out until the next morning. And I know that sounds a little hard for us to believe, but remember they'd had the feast in the evening, so I'm sure it was dark. She probably had some type of veil over her face. I mean, I certainly don't tend to know all of the details. I guess my question would be, I don't know that we have an answer for this, is where was Rachel? Did they hide her away? I mean, what all did Laban do to keep her from finding out about this? You know, again, there's a lot of stuff that we don't know. But anyway, Jacob is none too pleased with this development. He speaks to Laban. He wants to know why Laban deceived him. Laban explains. What was his explanation? Now, when do you think would have been a good time to mention that? Maybe prior to the 7 years? Yeah, it's a little late to be telling that. So, I think we're beginning to see, obviously, the makings of a very deceitful fellow here with Laban. All right, so he agrees to give him Rachel after 1 week. He says, okay, fulfill the week, you know, for Leah, and then I will give you Rachel as well, provided that you work for 7 more years. You remember when Jacob went away? What did his mother Rebekah tell him? You know, obviously, she was concerned about how mad Esau was. How long did she tell him to stay? She said, go and stay for a few days. until Esau kind of simmers down a little bit. Stayed a lot longer than a few days, didn't he? And in fact, the grand total winds up being how long?
20 years.
Yeah. So seven, and then seven, and then, you know, working with the flocks for six more even after that. Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. I don't think we necessarily had to be told that in the text, because we could have picked up on it even without that commentary, right? But it does say that specifically. And when the Lord saw that, looked at this text a few minutes ago, he opened Leah's womb. Leah then bore Jacob four sons: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And then she stopped bearing. All right, let's stop there for just a minute. We talked a little bit about this, but in verse 32, I want us to just observe what it is that Leah is really longing for. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, "The Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me." Verse 33. Then she conceived again and bore a son, and said, "Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also," and called his name Simeon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, "Now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons." Therefore his name was called Levi. And you notice all these names fit in or go right with the, you know, what she says here. You know, they kind of describe the condition or the situation. So here's the thing. We know that Rachel winds up having many more sons, at least four more sons than Rachel does. She is more fruitful in that sense. But what does she long for more than anything else?
Israel's love.
Yeah. Yeah. She wanted her husband's love. She wanted Jacob's love. And I guess the thought occurred to me in all this is they obviously had plenty of physical relations together. Physical relations don't equal love, do they? We all know the marriage bed, undefiled, Hebrews 13, and so forth. Yeah, that's a blessing that God gives to married people, but physical relations don't equate to love. There's much more to it than that. And that's really what she was wanting more than anything else. Now, it should go without saying, but we know God's original plan was what? One man or one woman. And God doesn't have to explain himself to me, but it's not hard to look at accounts like this and see the wisdom, certainly, in that. Okay, so move on into Genesis chapter 30. Rachel, who is barren, envies Leah and demands that Jacob give her children. She's insistent about that. How does she word it there at the end of verse 1? "Give me children or else I die." I mean, that meant so much to her. And Jacob's response was what? "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" All right, so Rachel then offers Bilhah so that Jacob can have children by her. This will kind of make, obviously Rachel thinks this will make her feel much better. She'll sort of, in a way, claim them as her own. And Bilhah has two sons. Dan, which means judge. "God has judged my case. Give me this child." And then Naphtali, which means "my wrestling." What does she say in connection with that? Why is he called Naphtali, which means wrestling? What does she say? "I have wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." And so even the names themselves show the tension between the two sisters, the competition, the envy, our bitterness, and so forth.
Wait a minute. "You see into his house with death, and that thing prompted that he was bad upon that she's doing for a different reason, but she's still using her handmaiden to have
this prompted." Right. Leah then gives her maid. She sees that she's stopped bearing. We mentioned that just a few minutes ago. And she gives her maid, Zilpah, to Jacob, who bears two sons. One of them's named Gad, which means fortune. There's a little disagreement in the text about whether this means, I think in the New King James, what does it say? Then Leah said, a troop comes. So she called his name Gad. Some of the manuscripts read more like, how fortunate am I? And so the idea behind Gad is more fortune than it means troop. And again, exactly what is right on all of that, I'm not sure. And then, of course, Asher means happy. Rachel and Leah strike a deal over mandrakes. Let's just stop there for a minute. Anybody know what a mandrake is? You ever had a mandrake? If you haven't been in that part of the world, you probably haven't. From what I understand, it's a fruit. It's kind of like, from what I've read, it looks like a very small yellow apple. In fact, I heard it's about the size of a nutmeg. I'm not real familiar with nutmegs. I don't even know exactly how large they are. But anyway, it's real small. But why would there be such an interest in the mandrakes? You know?
Fertility.
Yeah, it was supposed to be an aid to fertility. It was supposed to aid in conception, childbearing. That was the idea behind it. And so when Reuben goes out and gets these mandrakes for his mother Leah, that's why Rachel is so interested in obtaining them for herself. And so they kind of strike a deal. Rachel says, okay, well, we can lie with you tonight and then we'll get the mandrakes. Obviously, Rachel is very concerned about her barrenness. Okay? She wants to be able to have children. So, again, Leah has two more sons after that. Issachar, which means God, our wages. God has given me my wages. Zebulun, which means dwelling. And there again, the significance of that. What does she say there in verse 20? God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. She's still longing for that, right? Okay. And she also has a daughter named Dinah. Certainly don't want to neglect the young lady. Actually, we'll read more about her in next week's lesson. Okay, anything to add, any of that, before we go any further? Okay. Continuing on in chapter 30, God opens Rachel's womb, and she has a son named Joseph. That name means he will add. God has added to me a son. Jacob then asked Laban to send him away. But Laban asked him to stay and says Jacob can name his wages. He's going to regret having done that, right? Jacob then comes up with, we're just going to call it the speckled and spotted livestock plant. Okay, y'all read about that. You know what happens there. And I asked the question earlier, did the peeled bark do it or did God simply bless Jacob? Again, the idea that has long been held and may still be held by some is, you know, animals, when they go to conceive, it's like the last thing they look at. You know, whatever they bear will resemble them, whatever they last look at, or at least will affect the conception. And so I guess you would have these white and dark spots, you know, on this peeled bark, and that's supposed to produce the speckle effect. And so it would help to increase the flocks. But in the end, what is the result of all of this, bottom line? What happens to Jacob's flock contrasted with Laban's flock? Yeah, oh, yeah, he got the better of that. Jacob do anything wrong in this? I'm asking for a friend. No, but they're not always rebuked for things they've done wrong. What do you think?
I think he trusted in God that he would overcome whatever
Well, yeah. And what happens in chapter 31? What, remember the dream that Jacob relates to Rachel and Leah? What does God show him in a dream? You know, as it relates to this livestock, what did God show him in a dream? The speckled and spotted and streaked ram sleeping over the flocks. Mr. Jesse said earlier what he's not rebuked for, well, this seems to be some confirmation or some assurance to Jacob that this is going to work out to your favor and to your blessing. And when Jacob later defends himself to Laban, there's the point made about this agreement and all that they had. I think Jacob was confident that, you know, he had done nothing wrong. And so, I mean, I don't really think so. I mean, obviously, I stand to be corrected if you can point out something in all of that. I do know, and we don't learn this till later, when Jacob is talking to Rachel and Leah, and then, of course, to Laban himself. But Laban changes his ways, what? 10 times. I mean, I don't know what all that involved, but, I mean, it just, and he was, you know, not treating him very well at all. Bottom line, as it's expressed at the end of chapter 30, is, thus the man, speaking of Jacob, became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Question about that. There's something said later in chapter 32. Let's contrast this with Isaac. When Abraham sent Isaac's servant to go and find a wife for Isaac, what did Abraham send with that servant as an enticement for this prospective wife? Oh, a whole bunch of stuff, right? Yeah, wound up giving some nice jewelry to Rebecca, gave some to the mother and the brother, and, I mean, yeah, it was just a bountiful gift. What did Jacob go with? You know, over in chapter 32, he's going to talk about how he crossed the river with a staff. Now, he didn't, of course, have time to assemble a whole lot, right, because he was fleeing from. So, a major difference. So, he comes there with nothing. And, of course, now you see him prospering. And again, God is behind it. And what does Laban say? On a couple of different occasions, he said, look, I know that God is blessing me because of you. Now, he you know, it's obvious to Laban. Yeah.
And he's all this Jacob being blessed and coming into play before he meets Esau, his brother.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, chapter 31. Jacob knows he's in trouble. He hears what Laban's sons are saying. He sees the change in Laban's demeanor. There's his countenance had changed. I think that's I don't think countenance means just the look on your face, although that can tell a lot, just his demeanor. Jacob sends for Rachel and Leah, explains their father's injustices, well, it should be to them, and tells them of a dream where the angel of God spoke to him. This is the one we've referenced a couple of times already about the streaked and speckled and spotted. But then also in verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Read about that last week. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family. So there's God speaking to him again. Well, what is Rachel Leah's response to everything that Jacob says to them?
They're ready to go, right?
They're all in on this. So they leave without Laban knowing, but not before Rachel steals her father's household idols. Now, in reading various statements by these family members, not just Laban, but his father and so forth, obviously there was some respect for God, for the one true God. But clearly there's also mixed in with that some idolatry, right? Because, in other words, Laban had some household idols. So there's an issue there with that. And
And obviously this doesn't speak well for Rachel at all. Laban is told on the third day that Jacob has fled. Pursues him for 7 days, overtakes him in the mountains of Gilead. Now, if you look up Haran on the map, go down to the mountains of Gilead, that's a long trip. It's a long trip, actually. They were getting after it. God told Laban in a dream, we mentioned this earlier, to be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Laban questions Jacob why he left in the manner he did and accuses him of stealing his gods. You took my daughters almost like they're like captives or something. Why are you rushing off like that? I didn't have a chance to kiss them. And then he says something, I'll let y'all be the judge of how disingenuous this might have been, but what kind of send-off would he say he would have given Jacob? Yeah, he said, I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with temple and harp. Well, based on what we observed about Laban's sons and Laban's demeanor toward Jacob after his flocks were strengthened and Laban's were not, I don't think there was any intention given any kind of send-off like that. So you should have allowed me to kiss my sons and daughters and all this kind of thing. Well, Jacob responds by saying that he was afraid Laban would take his daughters by force. And as for the gods, find who took them and kill them. Now what's it? Do not let him with them. You find whoever has taken your household stuff, don't let them in. What did Jacob not know? He did not know that Rachel had taken him. So the search begins, right? Laban searched through the tents, who lived, the two handmaidens, and of course he finally works his way to Rachel's tent. He's unable to find them because Rachel put them in a camel saddle and sat on them. And she said that she couldn't get up. She explains that as, I'm in the matter of women, and I think we all understand situation of that. But again, we've made the comment, this does not in any way speak well for Rachel that even she was that concerned about taking those idols in the first place. Jacob is angry and rebukes Laban, talks about his faithfulness and the 20 years he served him, contrasting that with Laban's injustices toward him. He even talks about all that he went through, you know, in the day I had to face these droughts, and then there were times when I was out there in the frost and so forth. I mean, and you know, things that were stolen or torn, I had to account for those myself. And he kind of just goes through and details all of that. Well, then Jacob and Laban make a covenant of peace, with Laban stipulating that Jacob do no harm to his daughters or take other wives besides them. And then they set up a heap of stones with this agreement. That is Laban, will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. And the next morning, of course, they part ways. All right, so as we get into chapter 32. Jacob goes on his way. The angels of God meet him. He calls that place Naadam, which means double camp or two camps. Jacob sends messengers to Esau, hoping to find favor in his sight, but finds out Esau is coming to meet him with 400 men. And so Jacob says, well, that'll be just fine. Was that his response? Yeah, it said he was, afraid and greatly distressed. He was in a fix. Jacob is very distressed, decides to divide his people into two companies. And what was the reasoning behind that? Yeah, they attack one and the other can get away. Jacob prays to God, reminds him of the promises he made, thanks him for his mercies, and specifically asks for deliverance from Esau. One passage that I want to make sure that we read, because this reflects very, very well on Jacob. 32:10. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant.
For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two kinds. So if you're looking for things to help you in your prayers, things that should be said. Now, I know some of the specifics here would not apply to us, but in terms of not being worthy of the least of the mercies of God, the truth that He has shown us, certainly that's a very commendable attitude. Jacob gathers a large amount of livestock to go before him as a present to Esau. It's kind of interesting how he lines those up, right? He has them divided up into droves, is the way the New King James has it. We're going to march one drove out there, and then there'll be a little bit of separation. We'll have another drove. And that'd be kind of impressive, wouldn't it? It'd be kind of impressive to see that continuing string of all of that. So he's got that in mind. He even gives his instructions, servants. Gives instructions to his servants on what to say when they meet Esau. This is a present from Esau, and he is right behind me. This is how they're supposed to do it. Well, later that night, Jacob sent his family and possessions over the ford of the Jabbok River. But he stayed behind. And now what unfolds? He wrestled that night with a man. Now that in quotations. He's described as an angel in Hosea 12, 2 through 4. The angel told him his name would be changed to Israel. He who strives with Israel. Somebody want to tell me the significance of this statement? Really, what is this messenger of God saying when he says, "You have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed"? Let me ask you first, does that sound a little odd? Just kind of read it on the surface, what might you think? Yeah, how do you prevail against God? I didn't think anybody could do that. So what? It can't be that he's gained some kind of dominance over God. It can't be that. So what would it be? Yeah, I wonder if it might go back to the prayer that we just noted just a few minutes ago. I mean, he has, if you look at chapter 32, verses 9 through 12, the prayer there, I mean, he's just pouring his heart out to God. He's putting his full trust in God. I think that's the idea. We might think of, even the New Testament uses the terminology of striving with God in prayer. I think that may be the idea here. So I think there's reassurance here. You come through this, and I am going to take care of you. You've shown trust in me, and I'm going to see you through all of this. That, at least to me, seems like kind of the overall point of it. Now, there may be things that I'm missing it. Now, something else very interesting takes place. While they're wrestling, this man, this angel of God, sees that Jacob is prevailing over him, and so what does the angel do? Yeah, touches the hip socket there, right? Some of you who have been involved in sports before, and I don't just know if you necessarily have to be involved in sports before. You ever heard of a hip pointer? And I don't know if this is exactly the same. I doubt it's exactly the same, but and I don't even know if they call it that anymore. It's probably a much more technical name. But look at that hip joint, somebody get it bruised real bad, and I mean, sometimes players would be out for a long time with that thing, But anyway, it's kind of interesting, and I don't know exactly. Bob Walton says he thinks that it refers specifically to the sciatic nerve. I don't know exactly how he arrived at that, but. Says in verse 32, "Therefore to this day the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank." So just a very interesting thing there. Alright, on to chapter 33. We've got just a few minutes left. Jacob sees Esau coming with his 400 men. Here comes the one more show of partiality, right? He puts the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. Why would he put them last? Safest place, right? Safest place. Jacob crosses over before them, bows to the ground seven times until he comes to his brother. Again, now he's apprehensive about this meeting.
But surprisingly, Esau runs to meet him, embraces and kisses him, and they both win. Nothing like what Jacob had anticipated. Esau asks about the women and children, and how does Jacob respond? Another very commendable statement on his part. How does he respond? I'm sorry? Yes, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. That's his response. Esau says he needs no presents from Jacob, but when Jacob insists, he accepts them. Esau offers to lead the way, but Jacob explains the pace would be too much for the children and flocks. Esau then offers to leave some men with Jacob, but Jacob says there's no need for that. You think at some point Jacob is just in there like, wow. I was worried about him doing me harm. And not only is he not doing me any harm, he's just going above and beyond. It just couldn't have gone much better, right? Jacob went to Succoth and then on to Shechem, where he bought a piece of land for 100 pieces of money. Built an altar there and called it El Elohim Israel. God, the God of Israel. Now, that doesn't seem like a whole lot. But what's very interesting to me, go back through the five chapters we said tonight, there's about four or five occasions where Jacob describes God. And in every one of those, it's either the God of Abraham and my father Isaac, or the God of my father. Never refers to it as my God. So here at the end of this, he builds an altar that says, God, the God of Israel. That's not talking about the nation. The nation is not known as Israel. He's talking about himself. He is not. So I just thought that was significant. I didn't really realize that. When I came to it, I thought, I don't think he's been saying it like that. And so I went back and checked the references. All right, I think we are completely out of time.